This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
If you'd like to join me in welcoming Robin and Mike, we'll get things underway.
Thank you.
Well, let me add my thanks to everyone for coming on this Sunday afternoon. I'm a senior research fellow in our Centre for Historical Research, and we're very pleased to have Robin Davidson as a visiting fellow in our centre. And the format of this afternoon is one you're probably very familiar with. It's an in-conversation where a museum staff member or a fellow enthusiast talks to one of our guests about a subject that's close to their heart. And in this case, it's Robin's interest in nomads in the deserts and in travelling with camels. There will be time for you to ask questions of Robin or myself at the end of the day. I'm assuming that most of you have come to see Robin and are fascinated by her book Tracks, which was a landmark publication on a trip that took place 30 years ago. In many ways, we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of that trip. Let me just set the scene a little bit, and then I'll let Robin talk. It is 30 years since this camel trip, quite a remarkable trip even today, maybe 2,700 kilometres across the desert, across the Western Desert, by a young woman then 27 years old. It took place in a context when there was increasing interest in the Australian deserts. Warren Bonython in 1973 had crossed the Simpson Desert on foot. He should have taken camels, but he was on foot. The land rights movement was just gathering steam in the mid-70s with the passage of the Land Rights Act in 76. Papunya Chula paintings, that wonderful desert art movement, was just gathering speed, really didn't get up ahead of steam until the early 1980s. The homelands movement was just about to start with a push to establish little desert communities out west of Haast Bluff, west of Papunya, west of Docker River, west of Arionga. And they were all beginnings, but the camel trip that Robin is famous for also came at the end of a lot of things. By 1975, when Robin was preparing for the trip, camels had not been used as mainstream transportation in the desert perhaps for 30 years, really probably not since the Second World War. Aboriginal people had used them widely for travelling in the 50s, but by the late 60s, even they were moving on to clapped-out Holdens and other motor vehicles. It was quite a notable trip with camels, Aboriginal camels, by Dick Kimber and Sam Miles with an Aboriginal camelier called Mikini Jabarula in 1971. But that was probably one of the last big trips before we had the recent revival of commercial camel trips, except for Robin's trip in 1977. So we'll start to talk about the journey now, but Tracks really hit the mark, and it's interesting to ask why. And so, Robin, I just want to read a little passage from Tracks just to pose a question. Mm. We often see deserts as a place for an inner journey, and this trip had all the hallmarks. A woman alone in the desert, camels, encounters with Aboriginal people. It picked up on perhaps the idea that two-thirds of the continent is reserved for mystical experiences. So there was this is a book that had legs quite apart from just the magic of the real journey. So let's...
And being blonde.
And being blonde. So... Here's the passage. Anna knew she had to cross the desert. Over it on the far side were mountains, purple and orange and grey. The colours of the dream were extraordinarily beautiful and vivid. The dream marked a change in Anita, in her knowledge of herself. In the desert, she was alone. There was no water, and she was a long way from the springs. She woke knowing that if she was to cross the desert, she must shed burdens. That's from Doris Lessing's A Golden Notebook, but it clearly positions this as an inner journey.
Mm. Well, that's very interesting, all of that, because it puts it into a context for me as well. I mean, I've always thought that the journey came at a very particular time in Australia's, the development of the Australian psyche, I suppose. And it really has to be seen in that light, I think. The economy was still quite healthy, so there was the sense that you could do these sorts of things, you could do remarkable things, you know, I could land up in Alice Springs and now I get a job at a pub, or... In other words, there wasn't the anxiety around one's future that I think young people have today. Whether they're right in having that anxiety is another matter. But I think the atmosphere of that time in the 70s allowed us to have these rather big dreams. And also, I think, I was talking to a friend about this the other day, another thing that characterised that time, the 70s and onward, and the 80s sort of killed it, was the idea of freedom. And I think a lot of us, that was the prime kind of driving force in what we did, the idea of freedom, and I think particularly for women, for obvious reasons. And freedom, I think, we saw as adventure was like a life based on the principle of freedom. So there was that as well. There was also the sense that the 60s and all of that kind of political hope or fervour had kind of disappeared. People were sitting around talking a lot about what they were going to do, what was going to happen. There was a lot of sort of wondering, sort of listlessness, I suppose. And I reacted against that listlessness by deciding to do this journey. And, of course, there are all sorts of other reasons why I decided to do it, but, you know, I did it. As for the shedding burdens, as for that quote, in fact, I found that quote after the book was written, but it was so perfect because it was, that journey was about shedding burdens. Metaphorically, of course, shedding mental burdens, sort of walking away a lot of crap. But it was also quite literal in the sense that as I went along, I learnt to do without pretty much everything. And there was something so liberating and so freeing about getting down to at being so competent in where I was, that I was confident enough to just... know that the few things I had I could use them properly and I could keep going, so I wasn't afraid. I felt I knew my environment and I knew what I was doing. I knew my camels. I trained my camels. So I had that kind of confidence that comes from knowing your environment. And the gradual chucking away of everything that was extraneous was both a good thing to do in terms of cutting down the loading up time every morning, but also a very freeing thing to do and realising how little actually you need. And I would go so far as to say that the Central Australian desert, if you understand that desert, you can walk through it with minimal equipment. You really don't need all the GPSs and the radio wires. But anyway, that's another matter.
Robin, we'll explore the journey,
yeah.
But I think... it would be very interesting to hear why camels, why Central Australia? You could have found yourself, spread your wings, developed your confidence as a capable person in Kathmandu, but why Central Australia, why camels?
I certainly didn't want to go to Kathmandu. The whole sort of hippie trail thing, I wasn't interested in that at all. I loved the desert. You know, I was raised on a cattle station, or at least until I was four. So I think I have that sort of dry country smell that lovely dry country. I respond to it very well. I wanted to go deeper into that landscape. I was also very interested in Aboriginal culture from a point of view of absolute ignorance. I mean, I'd never met an Aboriginal person, which was, you know, pretty common at that time. But I knew nothing about it. I'd read about Aboriginal culture like I might read about the Greeks. And so that was another layer of interest. And as for why the camels, well, I had no money. You know, I arrived in Alice Springs with $6. And I knew that I could probably, because I knew there were wild camels out there, so I just thought, oh, well, I'll get on the train, I'll go out there with my $6, I'll get a job, and I'll just round up a few, or I'll find someone who's rounding them up, and I'll get some, and I'll train them, and I'll go. And actually, that's what I did. And I think also, one of the things I noticed on that trip, because it was, as you said, it was just at the beginning of the tourist boom out there. Literally, it was just beginning. And it was right at the beginning of people having enough money to buy a four-wheel drive vehicle and go out. And, you know, on the way to Ayers Rock, I'd come across these people. And what I found extraordinary was that here was this vehicle with all the windows rolled up and air conditioning and with two-way radios bristling everywhere. And I thought, that vehicle is keeping them from the environment that they want to explore. And I felt that having animals was the pace I wanted to go at. I do think something much different happens when you walk country. And I felt much more confident as an animal trainer than as a mechanic, frankly.
Well, I have to say that I came to camels relatively late, and I found them fascinating, absolutely charismatic animals, a revelation, and a wonderful way to travel the desert. Mm. When did you start working with camels? Was it in Alice Springs?
It was, absolutely. I'd never seen one before. God. Well, there were a few. Alice Springs in those days, you see, it was right at the beginning of the land rights movement. You have to remember that. And so it was a very conservative town. Not to say redneck and right wing, you know, really. It was pretty heavy duty place. Extreme masculine ethic in the way people did things. There was one shop, there was one terrible pub. A nightmare place. It still is, but for other reasons. Poor old Alice Springs. Where was I?
Camels, meeting the first camels.
And it was also a place that had completely lunatic people in it. One of whom was Kurt Posel, this Austrian ex-horse trainer, who had built a kind of Austrian folly on the outskirts of Alice Springs, where he was training camels to take tourists around on rides, you see. And he just didn't have the right personality as a tourism person, because the tourists had come out and he'd shout at them and say things like, "What do you think you're doing, you bloody idiot? Get off my fence!" You know? So, but anyway, he was really wonderful with camels, and I worked with him for about a year and learnt the finesse of it. And ultimately got done over by him financially, but that's all in the book. But I took two camels in the end from him and got two wild ones that an old Afghan chap had brought in. So then I had my four.
What would you say, what would you give to the audience as Robin's three tips for how to work camels?
Watch the camel day and night. Just watch for its behaviour. Learn how it works. That's the first thing. Just watch them endlessly. Adore them. Never let them take an inch or they'll take a mile. So. And don't be afraid to beat the hell out of them. Sorry.
You spend a couple of years preparing yourself for the trip, learning the ropes, learning how to handle camels, learning how to repair the gear.
That was the hardest bit.
Make the saddles, stitch them. So the journey itself, you're about to embark on a journey. What's the shape of it just at the very beginning there? Is it going to be the full journey? Are you heading for the West Coast? Or don't you know how long the journey is going to be? How much food? How do you organise your food? How do you set yourself up? How do you choose your route? How does this journey take shape in your mind?
Ad hoc is really how it happened. Well, I did a kind of dry run, if you like. Yes, a sort of practice run from Alice Springs to Utopia Station, north of Alice Springs, about 300k, with a couple of friends from Alice Springs, and it was in midsummer, February terror. Oh, I'll never forget it. It was just hell. But it sorted out basic problems like, you know, did the saddles rub, all those sorts of things. And then I had 3 months at Utopia itself to just sit down and refine it all. So that was good. By then I'd learnt pretty good bush skills. You know, I could handle most things, I think. And as for choosing the route, well, I knew I wanted to go through Pitjantjatjara country. I'm not quite sure why I made that decision, but I did know I wanted to go out that way. And really what I'd wanted to do was just go out that way and wander and just sort of go wherever I wanted and where the spirit took me. But at the last minute, I got National Geographic involved because I just needed $2,000. I know $2,000 doesn't sound like much now, but then it was an unreachable figure. So I rather against my better judgment wrote to them, and they said, yes, we'll give you $4,000, and off you go. And, of course, because it was geographic, I then had to give it more of a shape, you know, sort of from A to B. So that's what made me do that little loop and then across to the West Coast.
And what was the ability to call in at some of the settlements like Warburton or Docker River part of your consideration?
Yes. And I had hoped to pick up an old Aboriginal person, woman or man, who would take me through, you know, off track and just go out to country. And at Docker River, the photographer came out, this young New York boy came out, and I told him I'd been very definite about how to approach Aboriginal people and respect their privacy and so on, and he just couldn't resist, and he went and took pictures of people in ceremony, and they were really justifiably very pissed off. So that sort of spelt the end of picking up, you know, asking someone to come with me. And it was quite a low point of the trip because I felt quite depressed about that. You know, it seemed like the end of something. Anyway, then I was heading through down to Wingalina, which is in just below where the Northern Territory-South Australia border meets. And quite by chance, a carload of old Aboriginal blokes pulled up and stayed the night at my camp, and then in the morning this little fella said that he wanted to take me into the settlement, and from then on he'd walk me to Warburton. And that was Mr. Eddie, who's dead now, but, you know, talk about luck. That was an extraordinary stroke of luck in all sorts of ways. And still, it has allowed me to keep a relationship with that family over time, through time.
Can you tell us whether Mr. Eddie worked with camels himself?
I don't think so. If he had, he certainly didn't seem very... he certainly didn't... He didn't... I was very affectionate with my camels, and he didn't get that at all. And we'd be going along, and he'd say, put the camel down. And all this in, you know, Pitjantjatjara, which I hardly spoke. And so I'd kneel the camel down. And it's hard for camels to get up and down with pack on their back. So, okay, the camel would get down, and he'd hop up on the camel for a ride, and we'd go for about 2 miles, and he'd say, put the camel down. And so that went on. So I don't think so. He certainly didn't say he had. I suspect that he would have seen his first white fellow in his 40s or 50s, something like that.
I remember from Dick Kimber's account of travelling with Aboriginal cameleer Mikini Jabarula in the early 70s, in 1971. Mikini only had one piece of rope, and so you weren't allowed to cut it when you tied the loads on the camel. So it made the rope work very complicated. And just from my own travels with camels, I'm struck by how complicated the camel loads are. The saddles are wood and string and hessian pads. The load is tied on in all sorts of ways, but it's got to be evenly balanced. The saddles themselves are quite heavy to lift on and off the camels. You've got to hobble the camels and unhobble the camels. There's a lot of physically hard work. And for a large part of the trip, you were travelling alone, and you had four camels. How did you manage to work? Can you describe your...
A routine.
What's a day in the life of Robin Davidson?
A day in the life of walking across there. Well, I was on my own 99% of it, really. And so apart from the process of getting it much faster, I think the first time I loaded up was 2 hours, and really by then you're just so completely... You want to toss everything away anyway. And I got that, without throwing anything away, I got that down to about an hour, and then slowly even faster than that. And it's a matter of routine, but also being absolutely meticulous. You cannot afford to do one thing wrong or be lazy. You know, you tie one rope wrong and the saddle's off and the camels are pissed off or something's happened. So you really do have to be on the ball about that sort of thing and constantly watchful. And when I said that about getting to know what an animal does, it is about watching them and watching them all the time to see what they're, how they think. So it would begin before dawn. I'd wake up probably about 4 o'clock and I'd listen for where the bells were. And I'd stay awake until I... And I'd stay awake until I heard a chink. So at least I'd know what direction they'd gone off in. And that they wouldn't be too far beyond that, probably. Then I'd go back to sleep and get up about, you know, just pre-dawn when it was light, build up the fire, put on the billy, pack up a little bit, because I wanted the camels to have as much feeding time in that, that early morning feeding time as they could. So at the last, you know, just before it was time to go, I'd go out and look for them, and that would either mean tracking them up, I was a pretty good tracker then, or sometimes they'd have circled around and be coming back to camp, and in fact sometimes they'd sleep right next to me, and every now and then Bubby would, I'd wake up with his head on my swag, usually because he was after something to eat, but still. Then the loading up would be, you know, once I was practiced, it'd be about an hour. And then off we'd go, we'd walk 20 miles. And I found not to drink during that walk. I didn't have much of a drink until then making the camp at night and then swigging down, you know, 3 billy cans full. Unloading, letting them go.
Letting them go hobbled.
Yeah.
And so what, you know, your food, what sort of food did you have with you?
Well, I started off with all that terrible fancy stuff, you know, like dried, what's it called, freeze-dried. And, you know, in the end I lived on rice, flour, oats, pulses, tons of pulses, lots of curry things, the occasional tin of sardines, and for a real treat, a Frey Bentos pie. You know, those tin pies. And I was as healthy as could be. I mean, just no problems. And, of course, if there was tucker around, like, you know, I'd come across, say, solanum. There's a nice little yellow solanum out there, so I'd spend the afternoon gathering that. That was vitamin C. If I came into a cattle station, there might be oranges or lemons. I'd take something like that. But, you know, pretty basic food and healthy as anything.
I'm struck on these journeys that you start off travelling with camels, but within a very short period of time, you become part of a herd where the camels know you, they know your weaknesses, you know the camels as individuals. There's a real sense of your life revolving around the camels and the camels keeping a bit of an eye on where you are as well. Can you tell us something about your camels as personalities, as individuals?
Well, they are, animals really are highly individualistic, and the more intelligent the animal, the more the personality seems, the differences in personality seem quite extreme. And that was certainly true of my camels. The gorgeous one that I loved the most was a bull who, unfortunately, I had to castrate because he'd come into season the season before and he was, nearly killed me. And then a younger bull who I'd also castrated, and he was a sort of joker, he was sort of in love with the other male bull and was kind of nervous all the time, And, and then the cow, she was just very... She'd never been seduced by humans. She knew that humans were essentially the enemy, and if she could get away from them, that'd be just great. But since she had to put up with them, then she would, she'd do what she had to do. She was actually very gentle-natured, but you just got the sense that you couldn't really bribe her the way you could bribe the other two. And then she had a calf, which was very good for me because I'd tie the calf up at night and be pretty sure that at least she'd come back, even if the boys didn't. Who knows what they think? I don't know. But they certainly had a sense of humour. There was a point, and they certainly stuck up for each other because once I laid into Zelika, actually I didn't, it was because her nose peg was infected and she was roaring with pain and I had to change the nose peg and it was horrible. And Bubby, that one, came up and sort of pushed me out of the way, like really, telling me to not hurt her. Yeah. And another time when I'd let them all go because we're on a cattle station so they didn't need their hobbles, Dookie came up to me and he took my whole head in his mouth, so it was like a helmet around my head, and his sort of teeth down here, and I could feel him sort of slobbering in the top of my head, and then he just very gently took his mouth away and sort of dripped off like that and looked at me like, they're extraordinary animals, really extraordinary animals. They were fabulous.
Do you think they're very different from horses to work?
Much. Horses, I think, are more nervous, more highly strung. Camels are... They're harder to work in a way because they're more intelligent and they're not domesticated, really. They're very, very smart. They're not domesticated. They're extremely... It's easy enough to use camels in a group. But if you try and take one away from the group, it's very hard work to train them to do that. And I had trained them to do that, and I did have to use that sometimes. At one point, I had to go back and look for my rifle, and Eddie had to stay with the other camels, and I rode Bubby back at night about 5 miles back on his own, and that was pretty good.
Do you ever lose your camels at night?
Once, actually twice, I think. But once quite seriously because I think, where were we? We're on the Canning? I can't remember, isn't that awful? But anyway, wild camels had come in, so my fella's tracks were all messed up with the herd's tracks, and they'd really taken off. They'd been spooked by the herd. But it only took a day to find them, and I found them.
I still want to stay with tracks for the moment. But just a small diversion.
So long ago, I have to scratch my head to remember.
You've obviously met lots of other camels since then, including camels in Rajasthan.
Yes.
And I don't know whether you had anything to do with Bactrian camels.
No. A bit to do with the yak, but not the camel.
Well, staying with the camels, Rajasthani camels, do they differ in their personality, their outlook?
Completely.
How do you compare camels, the sort of transnational perspective on camels.
Okay. No one's ever asked me that before, but I'm going to tell you, it's absolutely true. Australian camels are charming, down-to-earth, witty. They have a sort of dry, dry Australian wit, you know. Indian camels, the two I had, were spoilt princesses. Snooty, you know, turning their nose up at things, awful to deal with, but much more elegant. So to ride, they were, it was like riding a cloud, and beautiful to ride, really. Hmm? Did someone ask that? And also they're trained, you know, you see them in those lovely Persian miniatures where the camel's head is pulled right back, and you can't understand how this animal can see the ground, but it's wonderful. So you've got the camel's head right here in front of you, and they're going along at this beautiful pace, and you're just sort of floating along like that. They're very, very beautiful and elegant. And I think the difference is that the sorts of animals that were imported here were for, you know, like draft horses.
Yes.
So they haven't got that lovely gait.
Yes.
But they're much nicer.
Yes. I notice in the photographs you ride in tracks, you ride your camels mounted fairly far forward on the front of the hump. And a lot of the Australian way of riding camels has really been behind the hump.
It's the different style of saddle. It's actually more comfortable at the front. I had three sorts of saddles. I had one old traditional saddle that, you know, the big heavy wooden mulga slats and big lots of stuffing that the old Afghan chap had made for me, and two saddles that I'd made, one of which was the long, you know, that riding saddle that you see in the old pictures with the person sitting behind the hump with the stirrups. And the one that I made, which was a sort of cross between, I don't know what it was, but it was like an Arabian saddle, I guess, and it had a square tree like that, that I could tuck my knees into, and if there was trouble, you can really hold on quite well like that. You've got a good grip. And it's high up because you're at the height of the saddle, so it's nice and cool and you can see a long way. And also, if the camel is mucking up, you just pull its head up into your lap, and what is it going to do? So you've got a lot more control. So that if I had a choice, that would be the best thing to ride on, if not to carry.
And do you routinely use nose picks?
I did, and I made them out of white wood so that they're nice and springy. What?
The camel's over you.
It's not a happy thing putting a nose pig in a camel, I have to tell you.
No, the way,
and I was taught this by the Austrian chap, you mark it with a leather punch, and then you get a metal skewer, like a knife sharpening skewer, and you just thrust it up through the thing, and it has to be behind a kind of flap in the nostril. And then once you've pulled that out, you just, through the inside of the nostril, you just push that up like that, and it hurts, I should think. But for control, you know, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. And because I was on my own, I couldn't risk not having that.
This journey, 2,700 kilometres, 6 months, four camels, one young woman, quite an epic journey. But let's move on a little bit now just to look at the aftermath. At one point in your book, you said it was awkward being someone with a label.
Yes.
So let's think to the end of the trip. You've done the trip. There's been a surprising amount of media coverage, and perhaps you're thinking, well, maybe I should put my side of the story, I'll write a book. You're in London. There's an expat community, I don't know, Clive James maybe, Jermaine Greer.
Doris Lessing. Yes, yes.
How did you come to write the book, this book, Tracks?
Tracks. Well, it is, as you said, sorry, that's it, that I was so surprised by the interest, and it was a global interest. It really was extraordinary. I don't know, it is like touched some zeitgeist button. And in fact, I remember at the New York Times, I think it was, said, named me as one of the 10 most famous people of 1978, whenever it was. So for a little girl from the bush, this was all a bit... it was just rather strange. And so I thought about it, and I'd written a thing for Geographic, and I didn't like what they'd done with it. They'd made it rather Geographic-ese. And then I got a letter from a publisher in London, and she said, do a book. Will you do a book for us? And I thought, if I write a book, A, it will, you know, it'll be my story, not all these other weird distortions of the story, and it'll be like chucking a bone at the dogs so that they're not attacking you, they're attacking the book, you see. So I went to London and I met Doris, and she was great. She was absolutely wonderful and sort of took me under her wing. And in fact, I wrote some of the book staying in her house. So that was all right. And what was very interesting about writing it was that it was two years on from the actual journey. And because I was so deeply involved in the writing, I swear I remember every single campsite of that 9 months. And it was very clear to me, every single one, while I was writing the book. And then as soon as I'd written the book, it was as if the book swallowed up the journey and I could forget it or something. Rather strange, that. Anyway, then, much to everyone's surprise, the book becomes a bestseller, and so the thing just sort of keeps rolling on. And I'm sure at some point there'll be a film, and that will be a further kind of nutty distortion of whatever happened out there. And so it goes on.
And I'm intrigued by the connection with Doris Lessing, because her Golden Notebooks, which you feature, became a feminist classic about bringing together the various aspects of your life into becoming a holistic person.
Yes, and your book
also became an iconic piece of writing for people to strive and achieve.
That they could use, hopefully.
Did Doris take you under her wing to the extent of saying, listen, darling, you write it this way?
Or... Oh, God, no. Oh, perish the thought. No. No, not at all. Who knows why she took me under her wing? It's a mystery. I had written to her. I was reading one of her books, I can't remember. And in the innocence of youth, I wrote my first and only fan letter. And I think I'd said something like, you know, thank you for your books, they're so useful. And I told her what I was doing and or had done and whether I should write a book or not. And she wrote back. And there's something quite extraordinary, her nose for sorting, you know, for sort of picking me out of the pile of letters somehow. Really remarkable. And she didn't help me write at all. Rather the opposite. But she did help me... I think she helped me steer through the literary world a bit. So, for example, she said, my dear, don't bother reading any reviews of your book. All they tell you is what the current... received ideas are. They'll be of no use to you whatsoever in terms of your work. And so I didn't. And I didn't read any reviews of tracks until about, I suppose, 6 or 7 years ago. And she was right.
Becoming someone with a label can be constraining, but it can also open doors. It can also be an opportunity, create opportunities. And you went on to travel with other nomads, travel with other camels, and really to develop an interest in pastoral nomads. Can you tell us how you got started in India and Rajasthan, and how that panned out?
Well, I think in some way I've always been interested in the way human beings move around. Now, early on, I wouldn't have thought about it very much, but I myself was extremely mobile and seem always to have been and to have wanted to have been. nomadic, if you like. And having got to know Aboriginal people a bit and thought a lot about why I admired aspects of their culture, and I started thinking about what are the key things that nomadic cultures do differently to stationary or sedentary cultures. So I was already interested in that. And then I thought, and I was at a loose end, I'd done various projects, and publishers are always trying to get me to write tracks again. So, and I wanted to discover something about other forms of nomadism, pastoral nomadism in particular, and I'd already been to India, and I knew people there. So it all sort of came together, again, in a rather ad hoc way, that I would try to live with and research this group in India, which was both a very good idea and a very bad idea, because India is just so very, very difficult. Anyway, it culminated in my being in Rajasthan and Gujarat for 2 years and going on migration with a group of pastoral nomads in Gujarat. And it was absolutely the hardest thing I've ever done, much, much more difficult than crossing the Australian desert, I'll tell you. But it confirmed a lot of ideas I had about nomadism, about the effect of mobility on cultures and why it has produced and why it is such a tragedy that it's disappearing. And I've just written down these statistics that I always forget. Okay, 10,000 years ago, all human beings are foragers. 1500 AD, it's down to 1% mobile. In the 20th century, it's 1,000th of that. So, and all mobile peoples are really being forced to into a sedentary lifestyle, and once that happens, the cosmologies, if you like, and the worldviews and the systems of knowledge that are based around mobility disappear. And so I feel quite... I feel it's quite important that I do something, contribute something towards that, to trying to preserve whatever can be preserved. I think we need nomads, actually, not just because they have systems of knowledge that might be useful to modernity, but because they're a wonderful... In a world that's becoming more and more bureaucratized, they're a wonderful symbol for the possibility of living outside the state. Because that's become almost... In the modern world, it is almost impossible to live outside the modern state. Anyway, that's the thing.
There's a Russian writer, fairly ponderous academic, Anatoly Kazanov, who wrote quite a famous book on nomads and the outside world. It's a very clunky Soviet-era analysis. But he quite wonderfully said of pastoral nomads, he said, their past is unique, their present is precarious, and their future dubious, which seems to capture it all. But in true Marxist fashion, he also went on to say that for some forms of pastoral nomadism, and he's talking really about pastoralists, not hunter-gatherers, that their existence depends on a sort of interdependence with the outside world,
yes.
With the trading for certain sorts of products,
right.
Or in some nomads are a specialised branch of village societies like transhuman nomads in the Mediterranean.
Mm.
Did you get a sense of this when you were travelling in India, the relationships between... Could you say something about the relationships between the
sedentary and the mobile.
That's
yes.
Right, and particularly the people you were with and how they fitted into the broader society and how that affected you.
Well, there was great... their economy was... They had sheep, 5,000 sheep we were travelling with, so it was an extended family group, 50 people, about 20 camels and 5,000 sheep. And their migration would usually be about 10 months of the year, often following the same route, but if the weather changed or there were other problems, they'd be flexible and go some other route.
and then they go back to the home village. But all of them, to a person, said, the village is not our home, the migration is our home. That's our home. So they thought of themselves as nomads. Now, the way it worked was, with these 5,000 dreadful sheep, was that the leader of the migration, the Mukki, was constantly going ahead, negotiating with farmers, for example, to let the animals spend the night on a ploughed field, on a cut field, you know, with stubble. So the sheep would graze on the stubble and shit into the field, and that was... Thanks. And in fact, the nomads would make a little bit of money out of that as well. So they get feed for their animals, a little bit of cash, and the farmer gets his place fertilised. However, with modern machinery, with new kinds of fertiliser, that is becoming more and more difficult. And as... So in a country like India that's in such sort of disarray, everyone's competing for that last blade of grass. So essentially what's happening now on the migrations is that the migrations are becoming very dangerous for the nomads. They're under constant pressure, they're being attacked, the police go after them, they have to give bribes to government forestry places so they can feed their animals. It's a really, really difficult life. So those old ways of connecting with different kinds of people as you go along in a kind of fairly symbiotic way is being disrupted. And the nomads are the first ones to lose because governments don't like nomads. Governments like people who are still so that they can tax them, so that they know where they are and so on. So my fear is that for those sorts of pastoral nomads, the writing's on the wall, absolutely. It's too hard. And a lot of the young people are saying, you know, give me a job. And I'd say, well, why do you want a job? I mean, don't you like what you do? And they'd say, we love what we do, but I just don't want to be at war every day. And also, of course, those relationships with sedentary people, which probably always took a lot of diplomacy, they're breaking down as well. And it's a bit of a mess, really. Because sedentary people also depend on these people for all sorts of things, like fresh produce coming in, like just gossip coming in, you know? Someone coming through, you know, what are the pastures like over in Muckadilla sort of thing, and that constant flow of information between the sedentary and the mobile, and that's breaking down as well because now people have radios and televisions and things like that.
What did you find your role was travelling with these nomads? Were you handling the camels? Did you get sent out to be a shepherd with the sheep, or were you just a diversion, a person with a notebook and a camera?
I was the straight man. I was what made them laugh a great deal. I was the sort of comic butt. And I think not unvaluable. Mm. Because what struck me about those people, one of the reasons I liked them such a lot, was they really used laughter and good humour to keep going. It was like something that they actually used in order to just survive. And we laughed a lot. I mean, there'd be these terrible days where the police, they'd have to give bribes and they'd lose all their money and someone would have come and attacked them and the ladies have had to throw stones at them with their stone throwers and someone else has got malaria and we've had to carry him into a doctor and just extraordinarily difficult lives. And we'd sit there at night and everyone would be in pain with laughter because someone would be talking about the day's events and making a joke of it. They were just great like that. So, and they laughed at me a lot, and I let them laugh at me a lot because it seemed quite useful that I should do so. Otherwise, I stayed with the women mainly, and we did some stitching during the day. and I loaded and unloaded my own camel. So I was fairly self-sufficient, but the real problem for me was that I couldn't speak their particular language. So that put a lot of pressure on me. And in fact, I think that was the worst thing about it all. I wasn't sleeping, because it's very difficult to sleep in the middle of 5,000 sheep, let me tell you. And everyone was sick. They had malaria, and I had ear, nose, throat infections from the dust. And I was sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night. So, yeah, it was pretty grim. But I came out of there with such affection and respect for those people. They're really fabulous.
And this seems to have kept you going and on to yet other nomadic groups in China and Tibet.
Also going down the gurgler, I have to say.
Did this come about?
Yeah. I was interested. So I'd seen that sort of planes, you know, the relationship between mobile sheep people and local villages. So I'd sort of got a handle on that one. I hadn't seen high altitude nomadism, pastoralism, which is, again, quite different, because the nomads don't actually go terrifically long distances. They're quite short migrations, but amazing skill, because they're knowing how to graze at different altitudes, different animals. So there'll be the yaks right at the top altitude, then there'll be the dzu, and down at the bottom will be the sheep and a few goats. And they're constantly sort of working out how to, again, just extraordinary understanding of their environment. And that's what their survival depends on. It's not that they're environmentalists in any sort of romantic sense, not at all, but they... My feeling about nomads is that because their survival depends on understanding the world that they're in with such acute precision and being able to be flexible and adjust, that gradually a kind of system or a worldview or a cosmology is built around that understanding. So even though it's pre-scientific in the sense that information will be passed on in the term of stories or myths or something else, it's nevertheless extremely scientific in that it's you observe nature and you make conclusions about it. And that's what, of course, gets lost once they're... Oh, sorry. Once they're sedentary.
Unlike our friend Kuzinov, whose study was mainly desk-bound, you've been living your nomads. Mm. And it seems to me you've been propelled to the edges of a number of societies. You went to the edge of Australian society in Alice Springs, travelling into the Western Desert at a time when it was on the edge of things. Mm. You've travelled to the edges or the margins of Indian society and in China and Tibet also. Mm. How do you get in to a nomadic society in China or Tibet enough to travel with people? How do you do this?
You know, I've always used the same method, and it's certainly not anthropological. Mm. It's sort of just go there, see what happens. That's the method. Go there, see what happens, be prepared to go with things as they develop and sort of use your instinct a bit. It makes it much, much harder initially. But I think the assets of doing it that way are that you're not going in with any preconceived ideas at all, or if you are, they're ones that can't be eradicated anyway. And you're less liable to be fixed in a particular view. But it does make it a lot harder, and I think probably next time I would probably contact particular scholars who are working in the field, and I would go through them and I'd say, okay, find me a family and let's go out there. Mm-hmm. There's another... I do want to go back to China, because there's this marvellous old Buddhist monk in Cambridge in England, and he's rebuilding his monastery just outside the TAR border in China. And a lot of it's being funded by Chinese businessmen, by the way. I mean, it's so crazy, that country. And where he is, just near Yushu, there's lots and lots of pastoral nomads around him. And so he's offered to let me stay at the monastery and I can go out and just travel with the local nomads. And I think that might be a very good way of doing it, actually.
I'd like to open this up now for questions from the floor. I have one final question of you, Robin, and today. And that is, looking back to tracks, you know, it's 30 years since you did the journey. You've developed your interest in nomadic societies. You've lived your interest. Was tracks a turning point, or was it a seed that quietly lay dormant and then flourished later in life, which you then followed as it developed in India and China? Or was it a pre-existing interest that you explored? How does tracks fit in here in terms of your career?
Look, it's very hard to say, really. I mean, obviously it opened lots of doors for me. But I didn't want a lot of those doors. Oddly, I was very suspicious of the kinds of things that can happen to you once you're famous, and I was always rather suspicious of how distorting that can be. Anyway, that's a different thing. And I've also had this image about how I live my life, which is, I just chuck some seeds into the future, and by the time I get there, I just hope something will be growing. It's that sort of not having a specific plan necessarily, but just kind of assuming that if you follow your instinct or pursue things that you're interested in, it will pan out in some way for you. I wouldn't say it's terrifically good for the bank balance, that sort of life. But it's interesting. And so it's more the second, I think, that one thing sort of led off in one direction and then into another, and I suddenly realised that I actually had spent a lot of time with nomads, and why had I done that, and why had I been so nomadic, and then trying to sort of put it into a form to really think about what it meant that at the same time as nomadism as a tradition is disappearing, you've got the largest sweeps of human movement around the world that's ever happened. Now, what's going on here? And I'd like to pursue that too, because I think the two things are actually antithetical.
Robin, I think we've got plenty more to talk about, but I think I would like to give people an opportunity to ask their own questions of you. If you ask Robin a question, I would ask that you use the microphone that ISA will provide you with. Thank you.
Yeah, might sound a funny question. Can you talk about camel's feet? I did a little trek, a four-day trek in Rajasthan, and I loved it. And I was absolutely fascinated how, like, I was, when you said that it was like riding on air, and I was fascinated how they placed their feet like ballet dancers and their toes. And I don't know whether you've got anything to say about.
Well, they're just perfectly designed for sand, you see, that's it. And if you take them into very rocky country, they don't do very well, they can really rip them apart. Also, if they do get a bad gash, it's very almost impossible for it to heal because there's a sort of squishy bladder inside that foot, and every time they put their foot down, it comes out.
I was very interested to hear about the tracks journey without a discussion of your dog. And I think of all the companions in literature that I've read about, It's your dog that I cried about when you explained that he died. And the question that I have is, when you said, that was just a comment, and if you wanted to comment on that, that'd be fine. But you said, I'm sure at some point it'll be a film and further distort the journey. I wonder when the option for tracks will be up and who your agent is.
And who will play Robin Davidson?
Well, that's a funny story. Look, it's been through so many... I think the film's jinxed, actually. It's just gone through so many different attempts. Disney Films have got it now, and I think the option's just run out. So probably my agent in London will be scouting around as we speak. I don't know. I try to stay out of it now. The last script that I read, the one that Julia Roberts was going to play, was truly the most gobsmackingly awful script, where Robin naked is being carried around a campfire by Aboriginal men as she goes through dreaming initiation in order to get it to the so it's that sort of thing.
Hi Robin.
Hi.
I haven't yet finished your book, but I'm interested in what your experience is in coming back to society after such long periods of time spent adjusting to nomadic life, I guess, where you sort of, you know, you shed your clothes, you're minimalistic in terms of your food. What's your experience in dealing with that, both from the end of the Australian trip and your other trips?
Mm. Well, it's very interesting that after the Australian trip, I mean, I think that I got rewired up here. I do honestly think that there's something so profound shifted in my consciousness somehow, simply from being on my own in that environment for so long and doing something so completely different from what I would be doing in this environment. So nothing mystical about it, just different. So that then finding myself in New York something like 2 weeks later, and having this really deep understanding of how mad we all are, you know, just how balmy. So that was that. So in some sense, I don't think I've ever quite recovered, if you know what I mean. and it's very hard to recapture, though. It's very hard, you know, sometimes I go out to the desert and I sort of long for the person who was in that desert before. Funny. And the other, coming out of other cultures anyway, that muscle, whatever it requires, the wonderful thing about it is that your own culture comes in very sharp focus. So all the things that you take to be normal or... they're not normal. It's very useful to have that. And it's not just about travelling and looking at things, it's about actually attempting to be inside another culture and to what degree you can, to really participate from inside it. And then when you come out, it's very clear that your own culture is also very strange.
Yeah. Robin, I was wondering, what... do you see as the advantages and disadvantages of not travelling with a companion from your own culture?
I'm very glad that I have done it on my own to date. Again, it makes it so much more difficult for all the obvious reasons. You know, you're on your own and you've got to try and make sense of things on your own. And there was a terrible sort of loneliness when I was with the... not on the Australia trip at all. I never got lonely. But with the Indian nomads, I got lonely because I couldn't speak. And my survival depended on them, you know, so it was a not a comfortable situation, really. And I would have given anything then to have somebody just to talk to. However, if I had had someone to talk to, the whole thing would have had a completely different timbre, you know. So I'm quite glad that I've not, that I've done it on my own. However, recently, in fact, in the last year or two, I've been thinking about how I would make a series of documentary films on global nomadism. And I know that I've been procrastinating about it because I just don't want to have to go through all that again of being out in some dust trap, you know, with, oh, I'm just too old. I want to travel from hotel to hotel. Anyway, then this lovely young woman visited me a couple of months ago and said, look, you've really got to make this documentary and I'll help you. So suddenly the idea of going around the globe with her carrying the camera is a great idea. Yeah, so I think there's assets and liabilities always, yeah.
Would you talk a little bit, tiny little bit, about the difference between the Indian and the Australian desert? You said it was, you know, much harder in the Indian one.
Mm. Well, desert is... the question was, I don't know if everyone heard it, what the difference between the Indian desert and the Australian desert. Well, the first and obvious thing is that the Indian desert is highly populated. It's extraordinary. You'll be in sand dune country and you'd think nothing could survive. There's just one sort of tree and just sand dunes. And you'll think, oh, at last I can go, you know, I don't have to go behind a bush and have a pee. And lo and behold, there'll be a turban coming over that ridge. It's extraordinary, with a bicycle. So, yes, it's that. And, of course, it's had livestock on it since time began, you know, well, since whenever. We don't even know, but for a very, very long time. So that desert has been sculpted by livestock. Villages, there's villages scattered through it. One has a sense that everything in India is humanized. Does that make sense? That everything's been used. Every grain of sand has gone through at least one cycle through a human being and into a pot and out into a sand dune and into a human and back into, you know, it's that sort of thing. Whereas in Australia, the most wonderful feeling and such a privilege is to stand on a sand dune somewhere and know there's not a human being for 500 miles in any direction. And also, the Central Australian landscape is far more, beautiful is a silly word. The Thar Desert is very beautiful in a different way, but there's more things going on. It's just more biodiverse, I suppose you could say.
Mm. The other day I heard a woman, 20-something, saying that I can't function without my iPod. I can't walk without my iPod.
I know.
What would you say? Is there something lost that cosmologically or something in the life of the mind that you might be able to say something about that?
It's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, it's all too easy to say, oh, it was better then. And every generation, I guess, does that. And I don't know what it's like to be in the new generation of kids who can't live without their iPods. I don't know what that means. I can't imagine what it means. It's very interesting. You know, this second life, don't know, is it second life, second world or something that they're all in? So the way that they relate to these... To each other and to space. And I mean, it's just completely other. Obviously, I would have to say that there's a great deal lost. But if they don't know about it, then, well, you know? And if I can... I can remember in the late 60s when I lived with sort of radical biologists in Queensland, and they were saying... You know, we're already down the tubes. Humans have so screwed it up, and I mean, you know, compared to now, it was nothing. But then ecologists were talking about how terrible the situation was, and it's taken this long for it to filter through into sort of common discourse. And I remember one friend saying then, But, you know, the best thing one can hope for is that people of the future won't know what they've lost. So it's a pretty grim way of looking at it.
Robin, I'll just jump in here and ask one question. Desert people are quite renowned for taking also what they want from the outside world but keeping their own identity and society as intact as they can. Did you see uptake of new technologies like satellite phones amongst any of the people you're travelling with?
Not satellite phones, but mobile phones, absolutely, and particularly in Tibet. You know, they organise their work through mobile phones. Sometimes they don't work because of the mountains and so on. But, and bikes. And so I think the difference is that when you've got traditional cultures like that able to see how something improves their lives and able to use it, great. But when it's a kind of imposition, like this great tidal wave coming over them so that they can't adjust really in time or something, then it's... they're kind of up the spout, really.
Robin, what was the name of the book you wrote about your time in India?
Desert Places, it was called. Yeah, from a Robert Frost poem.
Can I say one more? What about water? When you did your trip across from Alice,
yeah,
as far as water supplies, and obviously critical, how did you organise that?
Well, my animals carried 500 pounds of water. That was the bulk of the load, obviously. There were functioning wells. So, for example, along the Canning Stock Route, a couple of those wells were functioning, though most weren't. And at one point between Warburton and whatever that first station was, about 400 miles later, the photographer dropped out a drum for me at about 100 miles, so that was terrific. Yeah, that's how it happened. And, of course, through cattle country, then you've got boars and so on, yeah. But often the maps were wrong. Never trust a map. Because they'd say a functioning well and, you know, there'd be nothing but sand there.
Well, please join me in thanking Robin for speaking to us today.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.